We'll call this meeting to order. We have several bills to look at today. We're going to try and be pretty strict on the time because we do have quite a few folks from out of town on the, I know for the Mariani bill, there's some folks from out of town that we'll want to talk to. Members, we have two bills for tomorrow, which will be our last meeting before deadline three. Representative Pugh's bill, Representative Nelson's bill, Representative Sertich bill. Okay, okay. And no, we're not going there. Okay, so with that, welcome to the committee. Representative Abler, we're going to be looking at a House File 1781, an Abler bill, and then that has not met deadlines. We'll be possibly, we're doing some work on amending it and then laying it over. Then we'll go to the House File 2436, which leadership has said it's a department bill that will go ahead. And then we'll discuss the Walker bill and Mariani bill, and we will be done at 2:15. And we do need to make sure that we get to the Mariani bill for sure, well, and the Walker bill. We have folks from out of town that want to look at those. So if I'd be quiet and get going here, maybe we could get some things done. Representative Abler, we do not have a quorum at this point, but when we do, I will move House File 1781, and then you have an amendment to it. Why don't you describe the bill to us as it would be amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of brevity and making the presentation more interesting, I'll just defer to my witness. This is a great bill, Mr. Chair, and the state's better if it passes. So that's my testimony. I have a witness now, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that clears it up for me. If you could please state your name, who represents the record, please, and present the bill as it would be amended.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patty Cullen, Vice President of Care Providers in Minnesota, representing the long-term care imperative today. Amendment A1 added to the bill has been worked out with my new friends at the Insurance Federation. Essentially what the bill does is allows local units of government, other governmental entities outside of the state of Minnesota, to apply for long-term care insurance pool benefit for their employees. Now, historically, this bill's been before this committee before. Historically, the concerns from the insurance industry have been twofold. Number one, that with having so many people involved in the pool, the state pool, you really place insurance companies that are not the CNA, which has the state pool right now, at a competitive disadvantage. So Amendment A1 does say you have to request new bids from qualified vendors. Helps open up the market to other insurance companies and insurance vendor. The other concern is that because when you open up this pool to local units of government, as well as when you open it up for the state several years ago, anyone who wanted long-term care insurance, regardless of whether they had pre-existing conditions, would be qualified and would be able to sign up for this, which means that there is some question about how cost-effective that the long-term care insurance product actually is that the state has offered, just because of the fact that you had to build in administration costs as well as the issue that there wouldn't be the pre-existing conditions initially were part of the pool. So their concern was, does a consumer know that they could get cheaper insurance somewhere else? So page 2 of the A1 amendment is language that was brought forward by the Insurance Federation to say, folks, here's some information about long-term care insurance that you're now eligible for, whether you're in a county employee, a city employee, whichever local unit of government has asked to be part of this pool, and they need to affirmatively request from DOER to be a part of this. And in the written information, you need to tell them, you know what, you may want to look around. You may be able to get cheaper insurance from other entities. And the ultimate goal here, folks, is to make sure that we increase the percentage of folks that take personal responsibility for long-term care, because with the demographics the way they are, the state is not going to be able to afford in the very near future to continue to pay for long-term care services. So the more people that pay for long-term care insurance, the more tools we pull out of the tool chest to allow people to pick, whether it's reverse mortgages, whether it's long-term care insurance, the better it will be for the state budget in the long run. So that's why we're promoting this bill this year, to make sure that we provide as many opportunities for folks. And with these amendments from A1, we don't have the opposition from the insurance industry. We have some folks that have come forward to say that it actually increasing the pools will actually also increase the private market, as it has done when the state expanded its pool, because people now get information about long-term care insurance, they think about it, they start asking questions.
Okay, thank you. With that, I should have asked earlier, is there anyone that wishes to testify in opposition to this bill? Okay, we have one gentleman. Any questions for Ms. Cullen first before she takes off here? Any questions? Okay, sir, if you could please state your name. Thank you, Ms. Cullen. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. And is there anybody else that wish to testify against it as it would be amended with the A1? Okay, please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Haugen with the Minnesota Department of Employee Relations. Excuse me, I'm here to clarify a couple of things and also to express a couple of concerns. I just want to clarify at the outset that this was not a Doerr initiative or a governor's initiative. It's not a role we have sought. In these times of limited resources especially, we think it is particularly important to stay focused on our mission and our core business, which is state employees, and increasingly to address state employee health care costs. We think it's also important to note that there have been changes in the market over the last few years and some additional opportunities for purchasing long-term care insurance by local units of government that have not existed in the past. For example, we know the League of Cities offers a long-term care insurance group product that was not available previously. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Haugen? Okay, with that, we do not have a quorum yet, so let's go to the next bill, and as soon as we do have a quorum, we will go back to the beginning, do a couple things with this, and then we'll look at, go to the 2436. Representative Abler, what does House File 2436 do?
Mr. Chair, members, this is the reauthorization of the Emergency Health Powers Act. The part that it brings it to you in particular is the last page or so where it talks about job protection. And this bill, if you recall, 2 years ago was highly controversial. The whole matter of giving the Department of Health or anybody a lot of power to do things that we thought they'd, you know, just better keep was hard to imagine. Then some things happened, especially SARS, which kind of said made them right. And so I agreed to help them carry this to reauthorize it as one of the leading opponents before. And we've talked to any group that we can talk to just about and work this with the department, who has been very, very helpful and understanding in this thing. We've got, I think, a pretty good bill now. The part you're looking at was brought to us in association with the chamber. And there's some about protection of jobs, and the department can explain it in a minute. But just in short, what it says, if you put into a quarantine and you work for an employer greater than 20 people, that your job will be protected for those 21 days that you're in quarantine so that you couldn't be fired during that time. And if you are fired wrongly, you have some recourses. And so, Mr. Chair, that's the bill, and maybe the Department of Health can embellish on that part.
Okay.
And you can ask other questions.
Representative Abler, what's the A6 amendment? Were you describing the bill as if that was on there? 2436A6, is that your amendment?
Mr. A6 could be taken up after. This is not necessary to put the bill in order right now. This is another. You want to offer that?
Oh,
that's
okay.
That's the other part.
Sorry about that.
So the bill's in order relative to this topic as the committee now sees it.
Okay. Is there anyone with the 2436, House File 2436, that would wish to testify against it?
Mr. Chair, there's another topic we should maybe address. It has to do with liability insurance for. Why don't you go through that?
Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Health.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The sections that I draw your attention to are sections 4, 5, and 6, and there are some definitions in section 3. This provides two different kinds of liability protection. The first is for volunteers to state or local government. If they're volunteering, registered with the government, following the emergency plans, they would have the same liability protection as if they were an employee. The second instance is for public health responders, and that's anyone providing health services in a region of the state when the hospital or health care system is overwhelmed and we're needing to provide care in high school gyms or armories or other locations. We then move to a version of coverage that would be similar to a Good Samaritan level coverage, so that they would have protections from individual liability during that particular event. And to get that coverage, the governor must issue a separate declaration.
Any questions for members for the witness? Okay, with that, we still do not have a quorum. So what we'll do is we'll go on to the we'll can't even lay them over because we're actually not here. we'll go to item six. Representative Walker, I believe, is here. And I'd like Representative Walker to explain her bill to the committee.
Ms. Chisholm, nice not to be here, too.
This one will be, do we have a spark before? Not yet. One more. Representative Abler, if you could kind of stick around, because we will, and Representative Walker, just so you know, when we do get a quorum, we will interrupt, take care of these two, and we'll get right back to you. So as soon as we have a quorum, we'll do that and bring Representative Abler back down to the table. Welcome to the Commerce Committee. Representative Walker, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I actually will be passing the mic over to my constituent, Russ Erickson, who actually has been working on this a lot more than myself. And just a note to the committee, this bill was heard in the Senate last year and passed out of the committee and was moved to the General Register. Russ.
Hello. Thank you for hearing me. This essence of this bill, simply put, is that a credit card should only be issued to a person.
Excuse me, sir. Can you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please?
Sure. My name is Russell Erickson.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. The essence of this bill, simply put, is that a credit card should only be issued to a person with that person's permission. The first lines.
Mr. Erickson, I'm very sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's actually, it's kind of difficult since there's not a quorum. The original bill itself, we've added a delete all amendment that members should have. We took some of the criticisms that we found in the Senate last year and it added some more teeth. The overall gist of the bill is making sure there are some federal statutes that say that this shouldn't be practiced. However, we're seeing in the communities that they are. And so if I have a spouse and my spouse chooses to fill out my information and request a card in my name, he can so do so. If I have a son and a husband with the same names, there's that confusion that we're finding on a state level. And so we're just trying to clarify on a state level practice that if I do not ask for a card, that regardless of the individual in my household that's asking for it, that I would not be not only given the card but not held responsible for that transaction.
Okay. And I thank you, and I apologize because I'd ask the two of you to step back for just a second if you would, and then we'll bring you right back. And members, on the Walker bill here, I want to take a close look at this because as bills go through the House floor, there could be amendments as such, and I'd kind of like to know what some of these things are as we proceed. Let's go back to Representative Abler, and I apologize to Mr. Erickson and Representative Walker. We do have a quorum now, so we will actually get things moving, and then we will. Okay, we'll officially call the meeting to order of the Commerce, Jobs, and Economic Development Committee, March 17, 2004. Representative Mahoney moves the minutes of Tuesday, March 6. Are there any additions or corrections? Okay, seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And I'd also like to announce at this point that tomorrow's meeting we have three bills up, a Sertich bill, a Pugh bill, and the Nelson bill will be up for tomorrow. Okay, with that, Representative Abler, I will move House File 1781, be recommended to pass, and to get in the shape you would like, I would now move the A1 amendment. Any discussion? We've heard the bill already. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended. Are there any other amendments? Okay, with that, we will lay this bill over. Now, the next bill is a House File 2436. This was the Emergency Powers Act bill that we just heard the testimony on. I will move House File 2436 be recommended, passed, and sent where?
Judiciary, Mr. Chair.
Judiciary. This one has been signed off on by Leadership Corner. It's a department bill.
Mr. Chair.
Do what I'm told, Representative Clark.
Just to help you out today.
Representative Abler.
This is the kind of bill that goes to almost any committee that is mentioned in our list of committees. I think this is going to go to 8 committees altogether. So if it would have been introduced the first day, it would be at rules begging for an extension anyway. So
Representative Abler, I still have the record, though, and that's last year's teacher statewide pool. I think we had 16 stops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not trying to beat the chair's record, Mr. Chair.
Okay. if that was the case, I wouldn't be hearing it. Okay. I will move the H2436A6 amendment. Representative Abler, what does that do?
Mr. Chair, that looks a lot like the bill you just laid on the table. And the Department of Health has been very kind to allow us to commandeer their vehicle to move this important piece of legislation on to more committees.
Any discussion? Hearing none, I renew my motion for the H2436A6 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion barely passes. Okay, with that, we've heard this already. I'll move House File Number 2436 as amended. Be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your...
Okay, now, I'm going to try and make a promise to Representative Walker and to Mr. Erickson that I will not interrupt them again. I apologize, and I thank you for letting us get that piece of business in the books, if you will.
Not a problem, Mr. Chair.
Okay, now, members, we're looking at House File 960.
It happens.
And to have it in front of us, I will move it. We will be laying it over. We will be talking about 960, and then there's also an amendment.
It's a delete all amendment, Mr. Chair.
Is that what we want to be working off of the...
Yes.
Mr. Pender's 1064 or the DE... Delete everything, with DE1. Okay, I will move the H960DE1 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, the AO41064, is that the...
Sir, that's my amendment.
That'll be your amendment for Representative Siepen?
Or
this is
correct.
Working with Representative
Siepen?
Okay. Okay, very good. Okay, so if you could please describe the bill as with the delete everything amendment, and then we will talk, Representative Dabney will present his amendment.
Yep, that's the one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to just read the first few lines from the bill. A financial transaction card must not be issued except in response to a request or an application for the card by the person in whose which name the card is being issued. The essence of the bill is that a credit card should only be issued to a person with that person's permission. A card was issued in my name without my knowledge. Can you imagine having a credit card issued to you without your permission, without your knowledge of the card's existence, or without any kind of authorization on your part? The card being issued because of the written or oral request made by someone other than yourself. I called the credit card company 3 separate times, and each time I told them I wanted my name removed from the account. I said I didn't request, apply, give permission in any way, shape, or form to attach my name to the credit account. I said I did not want to activate the card. To my surprise, I was told I would be held equally as responsible for any amounts incurred on the account as the primary account holder was until my name was removed from the account. So I said, okay, remove my name. The credit card company said I simply couldn't have my name removed by asking over the phone. And I said, how could they logically or morally use my name without my permission and issue a card with my name on it? Answer. It's fairly simple. My wife could. It turns out she answered a phone sales call from a persuasive sales rep. They made a very low interest offer she thought she couldn't refuse. When they asked her if there was anyone else she would like to share the good deal with, they offered to give her another card in my name. The credit card company rep said, despite the logic of it, they had the right to issue cards to people without their direct request. There was no law against it. I could not have my name removed from the account over the phone simply on my word. To remove my name, I had to get in writing an agreement from the account's primary member. I had to get the primary member to write a letter including names, phone numbers, addresses, social security numbers of both of us, mother's maiden names, annual income, employer phone number, and the signature of the primary and myself. I asked, what if the primary member wasn't cooperative? Then what would I do? A lot of hoops to jump through when this shouldn't be happening in the first place, in my opinion. What if I was in the middle of a nasty divorce? The response I received on these 3 separate occasions from 3 separate representatives of the company suggested that the current law allows this to happen. Not only allows this, but makes this unknowing person fully responsible and liable for the full amount of debt incurred in the credit card account. I asked the reps, credit card company reps, a few hypothetical questions just to test whether or not I understood what they were telling me. I specifically asked, what if the primary account holder died? Would I be responsible for the amount charged on the card? Answer, yes. I asked, even if I never used the card that was issued to me, never activated the card, or even if I told you point blank I wanted the card, I didn't want the card, and the answer from the rep was yes, 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 you would be responsible. I specifically asked, what if my ex-wife ordered the card, seeing that she could provide all of the information required by the credit card company to open an account in my name, such as my social security number, my mother's maiden name, and my employer's name, phone numbers, and addresses. Would I be responsible? The answer, again, was yes. I would be equally responsible for any amount that was charged to the account in the event of the primary member's death or the primary member defaulted until my name was removed from the account. I then asked, if the consequences are potentially so binding to me, how could they in good conscience do this? The answer again, sir, they simply said, there's no law against it. I said, then please remove my name. I'm sorry, we can't do that. In this day and age, when we hear all of the problems with identity theft, anyone who could assemble the information required to open the account could do this. This is another reason to close this crack in the law. This bill would offer added protection to all of us. During the Senate Commerce Committee meeting, the General Counsel of Minnesota Bankers Association came to testify against this. And they stated that they believe that the federal law in implementing regulation that directly regulate the issuance of these types of cards already covers these issues. In their eyes, it isn't necessary that state law cover ground that is already covered in federal law. I do not believe this is true, and apparently the Senate committee didn't either. During the Senate Commerce Committee meeting, where the Senate version of the bill passed, the committee, the following question was asked by one of the senators. Does the federal law allow one person to request joint credit on behalf of the other person without the agreement or knowledge or permission of the other? Someone who isn't present at the time the request is made, someone who is unaware that the card is being asked for in their name. The answer given is from the testimony given by the General Counsel of the Minnesota Bankers Association. As the federal law stands now, yes, one person can commit the other person to a joint credit agreement without the direct input of the other person.
Sir, is it only if they're married?
Mr. Chair?
Walker?
To that answer, I would say no. My mother, who's in her 70s, I do her shopping, so I'm on authorized user on all of her credit cards. And actually, I've been trying to deal with the situation myself the last few months. She got a phone call from one of her credit card companies wanting to update her information and making sure that I was authorized signature still. And misinformed, I don't know where the wires got crossed while updating the information. My mother gave them my social security number because she's my mom and she has it. And because of that, now that information's on my credit report. I'm not an authorized signer. We are co-creditors, although I never opened up a credit account with them and asked for my own personal permission to do that.
And that's on your credit report, and that's okay now because you're paying the bills, but what if you didn't? That could mess you up.
I didn't know it was on my credit report, but also not only if I'm paying the bills, but if I was seeking credit from somewhere else, not knowing the amount of credit that's already on her credit cards, that could affect my ability to get other credit.
Hey, Mr. Erickson, when I said I wasn't going to interrupt you again, I was teasing. Sorry. No, go ahead.
That's all right.
Go
ahead. I'm getting close here. Another question asked by the senator at the Senate hearing, is it permissible by current law for a credit card company to accept verbal or oral application from someone other than the person the card is being issued to? Again, the answer from the General Counsel of the Minnesota Bankers Association, as the federal law stands now, yes. And one last item was raised in the Senate committee. Why did I have to jump through so many hoops to remove my name from the account? The answer given by the Minnesota Bankers Association General Counsel was that the requiring all of the information is to protect us all so that the financial institution knows who their customer is and that all the information is correct. I say that if they're so concerned in collecting all the proof to certify my identity when I simply want my name removed from the account I didn't order, didn't use, and have told them I don't want, then why are they not as careful when initiating the account? Why do they attach my name to the account without verifying that information from the start directly with me? Why in the world do they issue a card without approaching me directly? Something is wrong here. It's my feeling that these practices should definitely not be the way things are done. I believe that only the person in whose name the card is being issued to should be allowed to request or make written or oral application for the card. No one other than that person should be allowed to attach their name to a credit agreement, even if it is a spouse-to-spouse situation. When half of all marriages end in divorce, the protection of a person's individual credit should be protected by the law. Who has the right to use my name in such a way? I believe a person's name is their property, and no one else should be allowed to attach another person's name to a credit agreement without their direct approval. My reputation, my credit record, my good standing in the financial community, and all that a person's name can represent should be under my control. I consider my name my personal property. The bill, as it's written or worded, would still allow you to put another person on your account. You could still put your wife, your husband, son, daughter, grandmother, etc. on the account. The only difference is that it would be done with the other person's full knowledge and full awareness. It could still be a gift, but just not a surprise anymore. And just a little bit of support, I guess some research was done here. There's currently legislation similar to this in other states. New Jersey has a similar proposal. Pennsylvania has a no liability provision. South Carolina has a bill. Connecticut, Louisiana, New York. And I didn't read all of the details in that. I've got one here from Illinois, which is very similar. It provides that no financial institution or other person or corporation shall issue any person a credit card in which two or more persons are joint holders of the credit card account, unless the request or application is made jointly by all joint holders of the account. And I'm done.
Thank you, sir. Are you aware of any credit card companies that just send out live credit cards to people?
I have one.
Issued and ready to go?
I have one right here with me that I didn't request. It's ready to go. We've got a sticker on it. All I have to do is call. And that was from...
of course, that'd be your permission. So it's not active?
It's not active, no.
Okay. That's a little different issue. Okay, thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Erickson? Representative Broad?
Actually, Mr. Chair, it's for Representative Walker.
Okay, go ahead.
Representative Walker, I guess I'm just kind of looking at the language in line 15 on your delete all amendment, and it talks about a person's permission, knowledge, or authorization. And that seems to be quite a broad use of all those terms. I'm wondering how you prove knowledge or permission and how you're thinking you prove those things. I guess what my concern is that there's some very creative people out there who might have a family member who determines to rack up $50,000 worth of debt, and they can, in participation, say, oh, I didn't know about it. So how do you prove that knowledge so that the rest of the cardholders aren't having to pay for those things as a cost of doing business?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Broad. You know, when we brought this language, our main intent was mainly around spousal, which is quite interesting. And then it moved into relative and thought and things of that nature. I think many of the card companies now do voice recordings and things of that nature. And hold on to, from my understanding, hold on to that voice tape. I think that would be one thing. If you're uncomfortable with the word permission and knowledge, I don't mind taking that piece out. The main issue is this, that I should have to authorize any information going out and credit in my name.
Is that broad?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would be interested in as this bill moves forward, in looking at those words a little bit more and tightening that up. The fact of proving knowledge just, I guess, would concern me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Sikora? Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Sikora. I think I need counsel to clarify for me. From my understanding, it would.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sikora, I was actually going to research this issue before committee and didn't have time to do it. There have been for a long time limits on the ability to which state law can control interest rates, for instance, on credit mm-hmm. cards issued by national banks out of state. There was recently a pronouncement by the federal banking regulator, the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, that sort of summarized all of the lack of power of state government to control national banks, and I was going to check that to see what it said about credit cards issued by national banks, and I didn't get a chance to do that before the hearing, so I guess I can't answer the question.
I just don't know whether we have the power to prohibit any national bank that might be located somewhere else.
Scorer, we're the Commerce Committee. We can do whatever we want. Your point is very well taken, and when it comes to national banks, they really do limit what the states can do, but we can find that out. Representative Walker, and then back to Socorro, then Gunther. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, Mr. Erickson just pointed out we had NCSL check with Heather Morton. He said that it basically did not preempt us from regulating unsolicited credit cards. I think this is a complement to what is supposed to be happening on the federal level.
Representative Socorro. Here, Representative Gunther.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if Council could answer the question. If this is a restraint of interstate trade.
Mr. Pender,
sorry.
That's fine. Would that be considered restraint of interstate trade?
First of all, for Mr. Pender, to that point, well, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question if Representative Gunther is getting at this because of the conglomerate multi-state former Gunther chain of grocery stores being in more than Minnesota.
International. Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, no, I don't think that this would be considered to be an unlawful limitation on interstate commerce.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe another question for Mr. Pender. Isn't it true that under existing law, even if, let's say, one person in a couple took out a credit application and only his or her name was on it, that if that person defaulted in any way or didn't follow through or died, that the spouse, the other person, would be still held liable for the debts incurred on that card. Isn't that true?
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, no, it's not true. Under Minnesota law, spouses are not liable for each other's debts.
Okay. On credit cards or altogether?
Mr. Chair, altogether, unless they've agreed to be liable for it, if they're a co-signer on the card or have some other agreement where they're liable for each other's debts, but otherwise they're not.
So, Mr. Chair, so in effect then, this is the only instance where that doesn't currently apply under existing law?
Mr. Pender?
The point of this bill, I mean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, I don't know by what authority this credit card company claimed that they had the right to collect from the other spouse. So I don't know that there is such a right. I know what he was told by his credit card company, but I don't know myself whether that was correct information he was given or whether the credit card company was being untruthful or I just don't know the situation, but I don't I don't uh, I don't know that he was liable.
Representative
Benning? One last question, if I might. So this bill, in effect, is consistent with other prevailing law as it relates to what one person is or is not accountable for vis-a-vis the other person's debts.
Mr. Pender?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, yes, that's correct.
Representative Lanning?
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just also just like to note, going back to my situation and the difficulty that I've had to get that information off of my credit report.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone, before we go to the Dabney Amendment, is there anyone that wishes to testify against the Walker bill as it is right now? Okay, come on down. You can all three sit there. Why don't you just get a couple more chairs up there. Is there anyone else who wants to ask Mr. Erickson any questions? Representative Mullery?
Mr. Chairman, I hate to keep asking Mr. Pender difficult questions, but since a lot of these come from places that have no nexus in Minnesota, they don't even have a branch bank here or anything, does the law even... Let's say it's a Delaware bank or something like that. A lot of them are out of Wilmington. Does our law not, or that protects spouses against liability for the other one, does that apply if the credit card agreement has something in it and Delaware law allows that? And then, since there's no nexus here, and does it protect them in the Minnesota courts so that they would have to go to federal court to enforce their right under the credit card? Or, I mean, it's maybe this is too much for right now.
Mr. Pender?
If we're not.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, I think if they're doing business in Minnesota by issuing credit cards to Minnesota residents, so I don't think the nexus is would be a problem for enforcement and otherwise. And generally, if you're doing business out of state with an out of state company, the property rights of the state in which you live, in this case the right not to be liable for your spouse's debts, would carry over to that transaction unless you've waived it, unless the person who has that right has agreed to give it up and abide by Delaware law in that instance.
Jim Muller?
No.
Okay. We have some folks like to testify against. This part of then what the agenda is for the rest of the day is we'll be looking at the Dabney Amendment. And they'll be laying this over. And members, the reason I wanted to take a look at this is I just have a suspicious feeling that at some point on a floor session on a bill that says financial institution or bank or anything like paying bills or something, that it may show up. So I do want the committee members to at least have looked at it, and I think there's been some good questions so far. So then we'll opposition to this part of it, then we'll go to the Dabney Amendment, and then we'll go to the Mariani Bill. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and give us your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Witt. I'm the CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. And last year when this bill was being heard, I was the general counsel of the Minnesota Bankers Association. So you've already heard some of my comments. Thanks for that. Really appreciate getting the good press. You took good notes. But, we did testify against the bill last year in the Senate, and we definitely want to get on record of being against the bill again this year.
Mr. Witt, we're talking about the DE-1 amendment.
Yeah, the DE-1 amendment, sir. My mistake. There's a couple different things that I'd draw to your attention. The first one is that this is dealing with financial transaction cards, which is a broader definition than just credit or charge cards. You'll note that ATM cards and debit cards are also covered by this definition of financial transaction card. The testimony that we've heard today has all been dealing with the issuance of credit cards. And the reason why I bring that to your attention is there's a different set of federal laws and regulations that deal with credit cards compared to debit and ATM cards. So we just want to be on record of making sure that we point that out to the committee. Also, when we're looking at this issue, it's very important to note the distinction between true joint credit, where somebody is a co-signer and is therefore liable for the debts that are involved in the transaction, versus what we had in the situation that we heard earlier, which is an authorized signer type of situation. Mr. Pender was extremely judicious in his words, as always, when he said that the credit card company did not get it right. And he is absolutely correct that the credit card company in this case did not get it right. Federal law is absolutely clear that if you are an authorized signer on an account, you are not liable for the debt. It is crystal clear on that point. So whether we're talking about the interstate issues or some of the other things that were raised here, the authorized signer on the account is not liable for the debt. That is crystal clear under federal law. The other thing that I did want to bring up is some of the earlier testimony concerning joint credit. Federal law was changed with respect to joint credit. One individual cannot apply for joint credit and make somebody else a joint holder of the account anymore. That was changed. That is no longer possible to do anymore either. I guess we are, like I said, we're opposed to this bill. We think that there are lots of situations where people do want authorized signers to have credit card accounts. In some situations, the person might not be able to be approved for credit on their own, so they might be able to get the benefit of being an authorized signer on somebody else's account, whether you're talking spouses in that situation or parents, a kid goes off to college or whatever, will not qualify for credit on their own. And one way that they can have access to a credit card is through their parent's account. Parent might want to teach them the responsible use of credit in that manner. So but I really think
that's not what we're doing here, though. I mean, they're saying they want authorization, so if there's an authorized signatory, that works. That's not what we're talking about.
And you know, part of it comes down to convenience. If you're the parent in this situation, your kid's already away at school, you don't have a chance to get signatures and that sort of thing. I think that's really the issue, is when you have a situation when there's somebody who wants to add you as an authorized signer on the account, federal law clearly addresses the situations where you can and cannot issue that additional card, and we just don't believe that this state law is necessary.
Okay, thank you. Next, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Go ahead.
I'm Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association.
What was your name again?
Tess Rice.
How do you spell your last
name? R-I-C-E.
Oh, like Rice. Oh. Okay.
I just wanted to point out that the OCC, the regulator for the national banks, is likely to preempt any kind of state law that would contradict the language in Reg Z. So there is a chance that any kind of state law would be preempted.
That's true with everything we do.
Yeah.
please state your name for the record and present your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Pat Martin, Martin Service Company. Today we're representing the MBNA, which is the nation's largest credit card issuer. And one of the things that I'd have to say is that we have a few questions about the bill, especially the substitution language in the Delete All Amendment. And we have a query as to whether or not substitution would include the issuance of cards to current customers. Sometimes cards are issued to people that either have not been terribly active on their account, there might be a new design on the card, and we're questioning whether or not that would include current customers that get cards sent to them for some other technical reason, even though they're current customers.
Mr. Pender, what does substitution mean for current customers?
Mr. Chair, when I saw this language, I assumed it would be where you're its renewal is already in there, so this is not a renewal situation. It's a situation where the card is not expired, and for some reason the company that issues the card wants to issue a new card to replace the old one. Maybe the name of the issuer changed, or they have a new corporate logo, or as Mr. Martin said, I think it could be a variety of things. That's about as far as I can go with it.
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think that clarifies that we were mostly concerned with the inactive accounts that are still current customers, and I think Mr. Pender has answered that that would be covered as kind of as long as it's a substituted card for a current card that is not expired. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Witt, Ms. Rice, or Mr. Martin? Thank you very much. Now I will ask Mr. Representative Dabney to explain the AO4-1064 amendment. Oh, I'm sorry, is there anyone else wish to testify against the part, the DE1 amendment? Okay. Representative Dabney, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment is a simple opt-out option for college students who wish not to be solicited by credit card companies based on the sale of their names or the transfer of their names by the educational institution to those credit card companies. And it asks or directs the institutions of higher education to simply, amongst all the other flurry of paperwork they give students, they give them the option of opting out of the transfer of their name to the credit card companies.
Mr. Pender, today when an institution, post-secondary educational institution, has their list of students, they can sell that list to a credit card company who can basically blanket the entire university, can't they, right now?
Mr. Chair, I'm not an expert on the laws that govern colleges and universities, so I guess I'll have to. I think it, unless there's a state law that says they can't, I'd say yes, they can.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney.
I don't claim to be an expert on the laws governing higher ed, but I think you summarized the situation accurately.
So this would, your amendment, Representative Dabney, would simply allow a student to say they want to opt out. It's not like they have to opt in. They could just opt out.
That's correct. So, Mr. Chair, the institution of higher education retains its ability to transfer its student roster to credit card companies and others, except for the situation where a student would choose on their own to opt out of that. I think we recognize that a lot of students are leaving college these days with a lot of debt. A certain amount of that is debt that they've taken on, a student loan debt that they've taken on to fund their education. An awful lot are also leaving with large credit card debts that are a real burden to them. And I think if you look at some of the analyses of bankruptcy filings, you'll often find that one root of the financial struggles the individual has faced often starts in college with undisciplined use of credit cards.
Okay. Representative Walker, do you have any opposition to the 1064 amendment?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, as it's been. Okay, before we get into questions, is there anyone that wish to testify against the Dabney Amendment? Mr. Martin? Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pat Martin, representing MBNA. On this particular issue, we do have a severe disagreement that credit cards issued to students are somehow a problem that would cause a student to have to file bankruptcy. These cards are underwritten, examined during the application process very, very carefully. And all statistics issued by the Federal Reserve Board, other credit study institutes have indicated that the student cards are closely mirroring, following the general population as a whole. For example, balances are carefully controlled on a student credit card. There are other things that indicate that the debt levels and debt ratios pretty much, as I said, mirror the general population. In addition to that, the overwhelming need for a substitute to cash for college students, I think, has been well established, and the safety feature of credit cards far outweigh any risks associated with that. We would speak in general to oppose the amendment 2960, not only because of the compelling need for credit cards and the overwhelming acceptance on college campuses for that, but also to just point out that credit card applications, as well as any other type of student information, can be opted out of by filing for the Federal SEPA Act, where the student has the opportunity not to include his or her name in the college register that is then transmitted to vendors. They have that opportunity already under federal law. So we would oppose the amendment not only because of the overwhelming acceptance and credibility that students have been able to gain by having their own credit card, but also on the basis of a possible conflict or at least duplication with federal law. I might also just add that many, many, many students, so many students, establish their credit while they're in college, pay the bills on time, and actually establish a very good credit rating for themselves. And the primary way they do that is by gaining a credit card and paying on time.
Well, Mr. Martin, it begs the question, if they can already do it at the federal level, why not be able to do it here, too? I mean, all they would want to do is opt out of it so they don't get all these solicitations.
Yes.
They can already do it, so
yes.
Why not just let them do it?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, of course, as oftentimes happens, the devil is in the details. This would require the institution to provide, under the way I read that, under Section B2, for the institutions to take on another compliance feature, and we don't know if that puts the institutions at risk or not. We haven't heard from the institutions one way or the other, but they spend a lot of time coordinating and constructing agreements with credit card issuers that then give them the opportunity, to some extent, to regulate the ground rules under which these cards are issued.
Okay, any questions? I meant we have Representative Broad, then Goodwin. Representative Broad? Representative Goodwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, I just want to find out, how many jobs does MNBA outsource overseas? What percentage of your, I mean, the reason I'm asking this, if you're going to say it's out of order, Mr. Chair, I want to know, because what we're doing is helping kids get into debt in college and then not having any access to jobs when they get out of college. So we're helping them get into debt here with these credit cards. And I think the reason Representative Dabney's amendment is good, because some students do not want access to credit cards. They would want to put their name on this list. They are trying to have self-control. They are trying to prevent themselves from going deeper into debt, and the only way they can really do that is by refusing to have credit card companies approaching them all the time with the debt. It's a self-control mechanism, and I highly support that.
Kind of like abstinence of credit cards.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Kind
right.
Of?
Yeah. Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, respectfully, I don't know the answer to your first question about the outsourcing. I just don't know the answer. I wasn't prepared for that question today. Secondly, though, the sort of comment that you made relating to, are these credit card companies just bombarding the students with credit card? And there's, I think that, again, I'll go back to the studies that have been done by governmental agencies that indicate that college students, by and large, are very responsible in handling their debt. Most students have a very successful experience in handling this sort of debt. And it is It's very surprising to me that their delinquency rate, for example, is absolutely not any larger than the normal delinquency rate for the general population.
Well, Goodwin?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, that might be well and good, but it puts these kids into so much debt when they get out of college that oftentimes they can't buy a home. And now, since it's so difficult for them to find a job in this economy, it really puts a big strain on their lives. And I know that's true, because even with my own daughter and her husband, she came out of school debt-free. We helped her as much as we could, but he couldn't. So he ended up $50,000 in debt, and that's a small amount nowadays, I understand, but a lot of it was to credit card companies so he could get through school and pay his way, and it prevents them from being able to have children and so forth, and they're in their 30s already. So I know, and this isn't the only example. I know lots and lots and lots of examples of friends of my daughters and my sons who ended up so heavily in debt that they have really had to put their future off. So if they want to do anything to control their own debt and they want their name on a list so they don't get this, that's just so practical.
Okay, to that point, Gunther, Representative Gunther, Representative Banner, Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Goodwin, I think the largest credit card company there is in the nation is in Sioux Falls. Do we consider that a foreign country?
Yep.
Yes. Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't. Representative Goodwin, are you suggesting that these college kids who are usually over 18, who can vote, who can go in the military, are incapable of determining their debt load capabilities, their ability to manage that, and assess their options for future employment, and we're supposed to fix all that in this bill?
Representative Goodwin?
Mr. Chair, of course not. But what you're saying is you're not even going to allow them to this isn't saying that they are, this is saying that they can opt out of getting the information that they don't need or want, that they're trying to control their debt, and that is difficult for some people. I mean, and they want their name on a list so they don't get that information. It's a privacy issue, too, for them. So I really think it's important. It's, yes, I do think there are people that cannot control their debt. And I think if you look at the people that default on student loans, you'll see the same thing. A lot of people that can't control their debt.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I don't know how this bill would solve that problem. And I'm not seeing all of that written in here other than you couldn't advertise to them. But I think most of them are responsible. And I think, as Mr. Martin said, the default rates are very similar to that of the general population. So,
Representative, to that point, Representative Rucavina.
To that point, Mr. Chair, Representative Vanderveer, getting off the subject here, as you did, it's always amazed me that we've, we allow people between 18 and 21 to get drafted or go in the military, get married, smoke cigarettes, and do all types of other things that every adult can do, but we never allow them to drink. And that's why I've had my bill to lower the drinking age, which I haven't gotten much support of from a lot of colleagues around, because you can go to, Iraq or wherever, then you come home, you get pinched, and not on top of that, you get zero tolerance besides. But, the fact of the matter is, getting back, I digress, of course, getting back to the bill.
I thought maybe this was
back
a time for an amendment, Representative.
Yes. Back to the bill and the amendment. What is being done here, certainly the bill itself, with the delete all amendment, I don't see how anybody on this committee can argue that what Representative Walker is trying to do is common sense. If you don't know that you were put on a credit card, I don't know why you're getting one in the first place. Now, regarding the amendment, Representative Dabney's, I can tell you as a parent that I get literally three or four credit cards coming in my son Victor's name. And all this year, my son's going to school down here, he's been telling me he doesn't have enough food to eat, so every time I go out, I go to the cash machine. I've got one of these free cash cards where you put it in and free money comes out, But anyway, geez, where did it go? Oh, there it is. God, thank God. Anyway, I used it last night and forgot again, Mr. Chair. But anyway, three or four of them a week. And he's telling me, my son, he's such a good manager of his money that he has no money to eat, so I'm giving him money. And he announced to me 2 weeks ago he was going to Costa Rica. So, you know, I guess some of them can manage their money better than I thought, or maybe not manage it well enough. Point being, I know my son is getting 3 or 4 solicitations a week. Thank God I just see him, and I tear him up before I forward the mail to him.
I
so.
Did that too. With
my son. I don't know if that's illegal or not, Mr. Chair, but I think the Avenue Amendment itself...
federal law.
I didn't read the mail. I just threw it in the garbage. Anyway.
To that point, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I think what we're going to do here, we have quite a few folks here that have come in from out of town for the Mariani. We need to give them some time, too. So we're going to hold this over. Members, I think you're going to see both of these soon. So that will lay the bill and the amendment over, but I don't think the discussion is done with that.
Hold on, these.
Okay, just another announcement. Some members have just come in. So I apologize. I had a list of a whole bunch of folks here. It's going to take probably another half hour, so I just cut them off. Okay. With that, again, the bill's up tomorrow. Sertich, you're up tomorrow. Nelson and Pugh. Okay, so you might want to look at those and see what those are about. I think they should go quite quickly. With that,
I don't know.
To have a force, I'll move House File 2848, be recommended pass. And I would like... I don't see any amendments here. No. I would appreciate it. Welcome to the Commerce Committee, Representative Mariani. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As we have talked, I want to give you the rest of the committee time to, well, you and there may be some folks that want to kind of a point counterpoint here to talk about some things. So there's some kind of emotional issues in this bill as I was reading through it. But let's try and keep her all... very gentlemanly, if we might. Okay, with that, I will move House File 2848. Representative Mariani, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And it is good. I think the last time I was in the, before the Commerce Committee, I was actually on the Commerce Committee. That was a few years ago, and I used to sit next to you, and we had some good times back
Yes.
there.
So yes.
Good to be back here again, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to do is start off to give you a little bit of just sort of background information on why I've sponsored this bill. And then I'd like to ask Mr. Bernie Hess from the United Commercial Food Workers to go through the bill really quickly. And I appreciate the opportunity. We visited a little bit, Mr. Chair, last week, and I had a good opportunity to kind of lay before you a bunch of different issues, which we're not going to resolve today, but I think needs to be before this committee and this legislature to struggle with. And so it's in that spirit that I offer that bill, the bill for you today. While the bill focuses on worker rights, this bill recognizes several things that may not seem to be the same issue, but are in fact closely interconnected. One, the rights and safety of human beings who work on the line of meatpacking plants. Two, the well-being of local, mostly greater Minnesota communities who have to adjust to high turnovers of employees who come to work and settle in those communities and have to adjust or deal with injured working age people in their local health system and other community support systems. Three, the meatpacking industry itself that is, I would argue, jeopardized by what I believe is a high turnover of employees. Four, the local farmers and suppliers of cattle, hog, and poultry who are dependent on a smooth-running meatpacking operation that can consistently buy their animals, but they can be disrupted by an unstable workforce affected by injuries and turnovers. And five, the local economy of these same communities who are dependent on decent wage levels paid by meatpacking plants, which are spent in local businesses. The bill reflects a belief that the single key important factor that in these operations that contributes to the health of greater Minnesota communities, two strong local economies, two strong animal producing sector, to a stronger meatpacking industry, and to the well-being of workers is, in fact, the nature of the workplace itself for these workers. In order to ensure a workplace environment that positively impacts all of these interests, the bill establishes in law a minimum set of expectations that protects workers and, by extension, I would argue, the community and the industries. Now, one would ask, why is this needed if many of these rights exist in law for most workplaces? And I would say That is the correct question. And the answer is that the laws that we assume are protecting workers are, in fact, either not being followed, are being tweaked to not do what they exist to do in day-to-day practices in some plants, or simply do not exist for the unique nature of this particular workforce and the unique nature of the of these particular hiring practices of this industry. This sector is unique. Some of you here have meatpacking industries in your district, and you know this. And let me run through quickly what I think makes it unique. One is that in recent, last decade, two decades arguably, there's been an increased recruiting and hiring of non-English speaking immigrants. In other words, those who are most likely least informed of their rights and the laws. And then within that trend, that employee trend, there's been an increased use of undocumented immigrants, individuals who are even more least likely to be informed of our laws or even to understand them because of language and cultural issues. I would argue also that there is a profit margin structuring here that's based on speed of production in an operation that involves very, very dangerous physical labor. 25 years ago, on average, U.S. meatpacking plants could move about 175 cattle per hour through their through the butchering process and the packing process. Well, we're up to 400 of those animals per hour. It's phenomenal, the speed at which these plants work. And again, bear in mind that this happens in arguably the most dangerous occupation in the States. The end result, then, is a vulnerable, uninformed, mostly uninformed workforce, a workforce afraid to assert its rights under labor law for some of the reasons I stated, pressure on managers of these plants to keep the line moving at all costs, keep the line moving at all costs, and finally, local communities who need to pay for whatever the fallout might be as a result of that. Let me close, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Hess, Mr. Chair, by saying that what happens in these operations is contributing to a tragic phenomenon in the American workplace. Since Mexican people in particular are the largest immigrant group in the country, they are impacted the most by unsafe working conditions in industries that employ immigrants, not just this industry, but clearly in this industry. A recent Associated Press analysis of the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics on worker death data, and some of you might have seen that story in the local papers here. It came out on the 14th of last week. AP analysis of the labor statistic worth data, death data, found that Mexicans were most likely to die on a job than any other U.S. worker of any other race or ethnicity in this country. Mexican worker death rates are 1 in 16,000. That compares...
Is that specifically to meatpacking or...
No, Mr. Chair, it's not specifically to meatpacking.
Overall.
No. Overall, meatpacking statistics are part of that, but there are lots of other occupations as well. 1 in 16,000 workers, Mexican workers, the death rate is 1 in 16,000 workers. The average death rate for U.S.-born workers is 1 in 28,000. Mexicans represent 1 in 24 workers in the U.S., but represent 1 in 14 workplace deaths. And so, Mr. Chair, with that as a background for the purpose behind this bill and the kind of bunch of very complex issues that are all related to it, I would ask Mr. Bernie Hess to go through the bill and then add his thoughts and comments. And, Mr. Chair, we did have individuals here from, I believe, Wilmer, Minnesota, who were wanting to testify but weren't able to be here today. I appreciate your being sensitive to that. I think they were able to offer testimony in the Senate not too long ago.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for this bill that's traveled from out of town? Okay. Thank you.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Bernie Hess. I'm with the Food and Commercial Workers, Local 789 in South St. Paul.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. We would like to thank the committee chair and the members here for hearing this bill, and we hope to engage in a good discussion and talk about some worker issues. And I'll just briefly jump through some points on this, and then I'll entertain questions if people or comments be interested in your reaction. We look at this bill as a reaffirmation of worker rights. And when people ask, well, why should these workers have rights, any other group would come up and ask for a Bill of Rights, we would applaud that, but we'd also say this is probably, in my opinion, one of the most exploited groups of workers in the country, if not in the state, simply because of their immigration status and a number of issues that come into play with that. Under a number of these points, the right to organize. Workers should have the right to organize or not, but be able to do that in a climate free from fear. Yesterday I received a call from one of our organizers who's working on a drive in southwest Minnesota at a beef slaughter plant, and he had received reports and today is collecting statements that the plant manager was pulling workers into his office one by one and quizzing them about union activity. That's clearly illegal under the National Labor Relations Act. Right to a safe workplace. As Representative Mariani mentioned, there's a 1 in 4 chance of you getting injured if you work in a meatpacking plant. Over 40,000 packing house workers have been injured every year. This is everything from ammonia poisoning, burns. I have personally talked to workers who've had limbs and avulsed to buddy cuts. When you work close side by side with workers, there's a tendency sometimes for workers to get stabbed. Also, repetitive motion syndrome. You have to understand, in some of these poultry operations, a worker can do up to 10,000 cuts a day. Also, the speed of these lines, which we would like to address, or at least have safety committees address, is incredible. The rate of mechanization in packing houses has increased dramatically in the last 20 years. We have facilities that the UFCW represents where they're able to slaughter up to 1,000 hogs an hour. 100,000 to 150,000 chickens in a day. Also, several hundred cattle per hour can be knocked down and processed. So these are tremendous rates of speed. You have tools available in these plants that make the operation much more efficient, but also much more dangerous. And this is a far cry from packing houses that were operated in the 60s and in the 50s. It's just faster and faster. And time is money. Another thing we'd like to address in this bill is the right to adequate facilities. This packing house that we're working on right now to organize does not provide drinking water. The bathrooms, and we're getting statements on this, have been locked and only open during break time. Clearly, there's some health issues and safety issues there. A right to adequate equipment and the right to have a safety committee to make suggestions without interference or harassment. And a lot of this, you got to understand, continues on because a lot of these workers are undocumented. And I know that we can have that discussion some other day, but a lot of workers are fearful for their jobs on a daily basis. And the whole issue of language pops up repeatedly, time after time. Workers don't understand their rights. They may not understand safety procedures. They don't understand company policy books. Now, the good lawyers do provide some materials in native languages, but most of the stuff we see is provided to workers in English.
Mr. Hess, how, just a question. I've talked to some folks, and they do like Spanish, Somali, some other. How many languages are we talking about for some of these packers?
In some of the large packers, Mr. Chair, it might be up to a dozen different languages. You have Bosnian workers, you have workers from Somali, from African countries, a number of workers from different countries in Central America, which it might all be Spanish, but also Vietnamese. We have a plant with Lao, also with Hmong workers. It could be a number of languages. But also, a thing that we might want to look at is trainers or co-workers that would be able to instruct workers or at least walk them through if there could be programs set up for that. But a number of, you could have up to a dozen languages in a plant.
Okay, please continue.
Okay. So the issue of language is very big, or at least instructing workers so they understand how things are run. Right now, another big issue is the right to be free from discrimination. And I realize that's a broad thing to talk about, but workers do feel discriminated against because of the color of their skin, also from the country they're from. Right now, there's sometimes in these plants, there's two sets of rules, the rules for the white workers and the rules for the others. Another thing that we'd like to have explained or that workers would need is how they're paid. Right now, there's a suit that's been instituted by a number of genial workers. It's called a donning and doffing suit. They have filed suit saying they were not paid for time cleaning up their equipment, working off the clock, and we expect a settlement is going to be coming down the road on that. Also, there's been a suit that has been instigated against Golden Plump, and this is not uncommon to see in the industry where there's huge discussions about gang time and punching in one card for everybody and workers still working after the card has been punched out. But these are things that we would like to have highlighted and explained to workers, and also that companies could clearly put down in their policies what workers are compensated for. Also, what we'd like to see is the right for workers to seek help from state and federal agencies without retribution from the employer. This bill is not just about union versus non-union, but because we have such a high percentage of immigrant workers in these plants, we have one plant where it's almost 98% Latino, that people be able to fully understand their rights under the law and that they not be harassed or struck back against because of their status. This bill clearly is a lot of emotional stuff comes out of it, but we think it would reaffirm worker rights, and it would also help workers be free from this exploitation and ultimately turn them into better workers. Right now, I think a lot of workers are viewed as disposable parts in these factories, these packing plants. And you don't last long in a packing plant. The average thing is about 5 years right now, if you're lucky. A lot of discussion in the past has been that, well, these workers are taking other people's jobs. I would argue that the reason that a number of native-born people have left the industry is not because of the pay, but it's because of the safety issue, and the rate of speed is just incredible. So that's all I have to say. I'd take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. And we'll open up for some questions, and I would like, there's some folks from the industry that might like to make a few comments also. But one question I have is, as I look through this closer, aren't on a lot of these points, aren't we just saying what's already law, kind of like it's already there, like right to existing state and federal benefits and rights? I mean, they already can do that. Right to be free of discrimination, I think that's already federal law and state law, isn't it? Sir?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What I've said throughout, I said it up in the Senate, and I say down here, this is a reaffirmation of rights that are in law. Though one could argue that because of a person's immigration status or the fact they're newly arrived, they're not made fully aware of their rights either by the employer or perhaps by people that might want to represent them. We have not done a good enough job of informing workers of their rights, and it makes them highly susceptible to exploitation.
How many, are there some statistics on some percentage of how many folks are undocumented? Is that a problem? In
I would say in some plants it might be as high as 75%. When you use the word undocumented, what you have to understand is there are some, first of all, when an employer hires them, they check their documents, so, you know, the I-9s and all that. But there's also people that go in and out of status through no fault of their own. A group of workers from El Salvador, for example, are here under temporary protective status. And according to the INS or whatever they're called now, they are in status, but because of we've got this huge funnel of things that are going in that they have to process, their paperwork is in limbo. We've had a number of problems being able to prove to the employer that the workers are in status. And there's over 46 types of visas that are issued that at any time you might pop in and out. So it's a mixed bag.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Representative Mahoney, and then if there's any, no other questions, or we'll do questions, then we've got some folks from the industry like to make some comments. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hess, you know, the chair alluded to the fact that many of these things are in law. My understanding of this bill is, and I'd like you to correct me if I'm wrong, and if so, if I'm right, just reaffirm it. And what you're doing here is trying to get a way for these working people to be better informed about what their rights are. You're trying to get the companies to be aware that this is what's in the law. This is what you have to tell, and you have to allow these people to understand it. Am I right there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes, this is a reaffirmation. This is an educational piece that both the companies and workers could benefit from.
Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
And Mr. Chair, if I can also kind of push a little bit further, I think in addition to that, and that's why I spoke about the unique nature of this industry and this workforce, there are questions that people have in their mind. Mr. Hess laid out the complexity of you know, people's status, oftentimes changing. And so there are some questions in people's minds about whether or not all these people should be covered by laws because of that status issue. And so this bill, I would argue, this bill clearly states, you know, from the legislature and the governor, if he signs it, that from our perspective, the fact that they're employed and they're working, that inherently establishes these sets of rights that are enshrined elsewhere, but because of the unique nature of this workforce, there's a lot of question about that. So we sort of lay that to bed. Yes, they have these rights.
Okay, thank you. To that point, Mr. Mahoney.
And very quickly, I just need, it's unless on page 3, the right to seek state help, you talk about trained staff in the Department of Labor and Industry and the Minnesota Occupational Safety and Health. We actually had a lot of testimony last year from OSHA. Mr. Hess, could you tell me, I know there's a difference between advisory inspections and surprise inspections. Can you tell me how many surprise inspections do they have at one of these meat packing plants? And just so the members, if the members don't realize, an advisory, which is very helpful for OSHA, and I've been through a couple of them. They walk through and they tell you what's wrong, and you're not fined, and they call you in advance before they're coming. It's joint management and OSHA. A surprise one is when they show up at your door when no one knows, and they say, we're coming in right now, and we're going to inspect the whole plant, and they come down with 1 or 10 inspectors and go through. So do you know if these plants are being inspected one way or the other?
Mr. Hess?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I've only been witness to 2 surprise inspections in the last 5 years from Minnesota OSHA.
And if I could do one quick follow-up, sure. Were there violations found at that particular time of any magnitude, not just that the floor was wet, but the machinery didn't have the covers on them?
Mr. Hess?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, yes, there was a rather serious one involving a bone cannon that kicks the bones out from the animal, and safety guards were not in place, and the worker was supposed to be freeing this up standing on a ladder. It was ridiculous. It was not a good thing.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hess. I believe there are several folks that would like to testify in opposition to the bill. If you could please come forward. And I'm pretty fair on time, 25 minutes for one side, 4 for the other, but we'll, it's the way it goes sometimes. Please state your names and who you represent for the record, please, and if there's some comments you'd like to make on the bill, you're welcome to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Yelke. I'm the Vice President of Human Resources and Administration for Genio Turkey Store in Wilmer, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Swedberg. I am Vice President of Legislative Affairs and Marketing Services for Hormel Foods Corporation.
Welcome to committee.
Thank you.
What we wanted to do today was to provide you with some information regarding this bill. We think the bill is unnecessary and redundant due to a number of the issues that were already mentioned. What I've provided, I believe everybody has a copy of a couple of page items. Also being routed around was a thicker pack of information that had more of examples of the types of information that we provide to our workers. But what I wanted to talk about is on this thinner stack of papers, as you can see in subdivision 2 under rights to organize, all of these rights are already guaranteed under the National Labor Relations Act. Subdivision 3, MnOSHA AWARE program, that requires that employers have safety committees. Minnesota OSHA Right to Know, we are required to educate our employees on the safety issues within the plant. At Genio Turkey Store, we have 6 safety professionals, 7 registered nurses, and 10 licensed practical nurses to help our employees. Genio Turkey Store has 45 standing safety and ergonomic committees. This is for approximately 5,000 employees located across western Wisconsin and throughout central Minnesota. The safety committees are comprised of management and hourly employees. I would indicate that in a thicker pack of information, we actually provided copies of minutes from the safety committee meetings, and you'll notice the names of the committee members are Hispanic and Somali names. Those are our two primary minority groups. Team members are also able to provide safety committee with information through what's called a safety suggestion box. Attached to this thinner group of materials, the second and third pages are an example of a safety suggestion that was presented through the suggestion box and the fact that it was and how it was resolved. The right to adequate facilities. Well, first of all, adequate is ambiguous, and the concern that we have is that we will end up debating what adequate is. Restroom facilities are subject to state mechanical code guidelines. We provide clean, smoke-free cafeteria areas and seating for all team members when they're on break. Right to adequate equipment. Again, adequate is very ambiguous, difficult to define. Common sense would tell you that you need to provide adequate equipment so people can do the job properly and they can do it safely. Attachments 7 and 8 on the thicker pack of materials address those equipment issues. Subdivision 6, right to complete information. The thicker group of materials, we provide a copy of the employment handbook that we provide to our employees. That particular copy is done both in English and Spanish. We are currently modifying the handbook, and we will be printing it in a third language, Somali. Subdivision 7, right to understand information provided. Attachment 9 on the thicker group of materials is our employee handbook. There are some additional attachments there that are food safety and good manufacturing processes that we have already translated into 3 languages. In the Wilmer facility, we've begun using bilingual employees as employee liaisons. These are people that work in our HR office, in the cafeterias, and their sole duty is to address employee issues. They don't work out on the plant floor. Somebody comes to them and says, hey, my high school senior has a problem. The employee liaison can help them on how to navigate the school hierarchy. Somebody says, hey, my car just got repossessed. What can I do? The employee liaison is there to help them work through that situation. We have 5 Spanish and 2 Somali. Bilingual production leads. We currently have 21 Spanish and 3 Somali. These are people that work between the supervisor and the plant worker to make sure that people understand how to do the job properly. So that they are doing.
Just a second. Yeah. At the Wilmer plant, okay, so we're seeing Somali, Hispanic, or Spanish, and English. How many languages do you have there? People speak different languages other than that?
In Wilmer, it's primarily those 3 languages.
Well, how do you handle ones that aren't one of those three? Or
we have, in our Pelican Rapids facility, we probably have up to 12 languages in that plant, and it's one-on-one people. I have somebody that, for example, Bosnian. We have English-speaking Bosnian person, and that person will sit down side-by-side with the person that cannot speak English and will respond to their questions or help them through information.
I'll tell you what, we need to vacate the room. So with that, are there any quick questions of Mr. Yalke or Mr. Swedberg? Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the tremendous amount of injuries that they were talking about, do you have a safety program, and what is your work comp rate typically in your plant?
Mr. Chair, sir, Representative, we have a very thorough an extensive safety program, as indicated by the meeting minutes that we have, and the involvement of the employees. Right now, our lost time injury rate is running right around 1 per 100 workers. I think the industry is probably 1.8 or something like that.
Mr. Gunther?
Your mod rate is what? Any idea?
No, that I don't know.
We're at 0.8, 1.3?
We're at 1.0. Currently.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. Mr. Swedberg, I'm sorry, did you want to make any comments?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representatives, just some final comments, I guess. The Hormel Foods Corporation represents 8,000 employees in the state of Minnesota. That's half of our 16,000 employees nationally. So Minnesota has been a very important state to us. Our employees, by far, number one, our brands are also very important. They're number two. We wouldn't have been around for 112 years. So we take our employees' safety across the board very seriously. The bill, in our estimation, is redundant. It will aid no one in commerce. These things are already covered by law or preemptive. And in essence, we support those. We support them across the board. We meet all of these at the minimum and level, and we exceed them in most cases with this. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Mahoney, then Goodwin, then we've got to shut her down. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to put the same question to from Jenny O and from Hormel. Do you have a record of OSHA surprise inspections? I know you try hard, but I'm just wondering if you had that. You know, there's such a difference between the two types of inspections. Do you keep records of deleting surprise inspections and the advisory inspections?
We don't keep records on the difference between the two, but in your earlier question or your earlier statement, what I will tell you is that we recently had an inspection that it resulted in what's called a wall-to-wall inspection for one of our plants, and that was as the result of an employee that called and expressed a complaint. With regard to employees understanding what their rights are and how they can get those rights protected, from what we can tell, the system works.
Representative Mahoney?
I'll have to ask the Department of Labor and Industry if those records are available, because I'd like to see.
And another point is we've got two companies here. There's more. I mean, I don't know.
I can hear what people from Hormel, I'm not a problem with that.
Representative Goodwin, then we've got to shut her down. We've got committees starting at 2:30.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just want to ask, why do you think all these charges are being made? If you're doing as well as you think, why do you think that there's such concern over the treatment of employees in your facilities?
Sir?
Mr. Chair, Representative, quite frankly, I think it's it has to do with union organizing and the fact that over the past period of time, the UFCW tried very hard to organize our facilities, and they have not been successful. And I think this is an attempt to raise an issue that, from our perspective, shouldn't be raised here.
Representative Goodwin?
Well, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry I forgot your names, but I just want to ask if you've tried to prevent those organizing efforts.
Sir?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we work within the National Labor Relations Act. There are guidelines that we have to follow, and all of the actions that we've taken with regard to organizing have been in line with the National Labor Relations Act.
And then, Mr. Chair, are you saying then that that the employees of your plants don't want to organize or have no have made no efforts to organize?
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me give you a quick history. In 1988, UFCW lost an election in our Wilmer facility. In 1992, they tried organizing our Barron, Wisconsin facility, were unsuccessful. In 1994, our Faribault plant decertified. They were represented. In 1995, the Pelican Rapids facility, we operate.
Sir, I hate to do this, but that is all listed on the sheet that was handed out. I'm going to announce that tomorrow we have the Nelson, Pugh, and Surge bills. We have to get out here, and I apologize, Representative Goodwin, and for you folks for not having an equal amount of time, but we'll this issue won't go away, but it does right now for today. So good government all the time. We are adjourned.